studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising, and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Thursday, August 27th, 2015. Award-winning political cartoonist and writer Ted Rall joins us to discuss his recent clash with the LA Times and his new book on Edward Snowden. And in the wake of the Virginia TV shootings, researcher Adam Lankford will discuss his conclusions about mass shootings in the U.S., plus upper caste Indians fight for greater privileges. Dalit American activist and filmmaker Thenmori Soundararajan will explain the violence unfolding in the state of Gujarat. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Chenjerai Komanyika. He's an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University. Hi, Chenjerai.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us. President Obama heads to New Orleans today to mark the 10th anniversary of the devastating Hurricane Katrina. During his stop, he plans to speak at a newly built recreation center in the city's lower Ninth Ward. Nearly 2,000 mostly African-American people were killed when New Orleans flooded after the hurricane hit in 2005. The Bush administration came under global criticism for its mishandling of the disaster and what many characterized as a racist response. Obama will also address those failures today, saying what started out as a natural disaster became a man-made one, a failure of government to look out for its own citizens. But the president also plans to laud the recovery, addressing the city's residents, quote, "You are an example of what's possible when in the face of tragedy and hardship, good people come together to lend a hand and to build a better future. This is a city that slowly, unmistakably together is moving forward," end of quote. A new poll by Louisiana State University found that most white residents of the city felt that they had recovered, while most blacks felt that they had not. Well, Chenjerai, what do you make of the president's plans to see what he's going to say today?
Well, I got to say, you know, I disagree with his analysis. Katrina was a man-made disaster, and it wasn't a natural disaster that became a man-made disaster. The economic violence and lack of investment in public goods was a disaster well before Katrina, and Katrina simply exposed those priorities. A report by Allison Plyler of Data Research sheds light about the so-called recovery of Katrina, supporting the feelings of many of the black Katrina residents. What we see is that the poverty rate in Metro New Orleans declined from 18% in 1999 to 15% in 2007, but then increased to 19% in 2013, such that it is now unchanged. The same is true of the child poverty rate. So I think Obama will try to offer a hopeful message that honors survivors of these disasters. But, you know, I think he has to be honest about what's really going on.
The New York Times yesterday reported anonymous military sources of an internal investigation in the Pentagon over allegations that intelligence related to the ISIS war might be deliberately skewed. According to the Times, quote, "At least one civilian defense intelligence agency analyst told authorities that he had evidence that officials at U.S. Central Command were improperly reworking the conclusions of intelligence assessments prepared for policymakers, including President Obama," end of quote. The Daily Beast corroborated the reports with statements from their own anonymous sources within the military and intelligence community. According to the Daily Beast sources, quote, "Assessments on ISIS should comport with the leadership consensus, that is, top policymakers' view that the U.S.-led campaign against ISIS is paying dividends." Chenjerai, this sounds so much like President Bush and the Iraq War. If it's true, what are the implications that the intelligence books are being cooked on the ISIS war?
Well, we don't know specifically who within United States Central Command is responsible, but we do know that Army General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has been notably less optimistic about developments in the war against ISIS than senior members of the Obama administration have been, signaling that maybe these members of the Obama administration are working in concert with the United States Central Command. We also know that there's a history of tension between the essential analytic dissent that's required for critical thinking about military strategies and, you know, basically what's going on in terms of who's leading operations in the field, you know. So, you know, I don't know. I think the defense secretary said, "I'm confident we will succeed in defeating ISIL and we have the right strategy." But we need to be deeply skeptical of that, particularly the emphasis on military tactics as the way to solve these problems.
And finally, a Swedish ship participated in yet another rescue effort in the Mediterranean Sea this week. The Italian Coast Guard was also involved in the operation, which found 3,000 migrants packed onto boats fleeing war and poverty from Africa and the Middle East. At least 55 bodies were found on the boats. Added to the death toll over the entire year, more than 2,000 people have died in the Mediterranean trying to escape desperate circumstances. European countries are struggling to come up with a solution to the mass migration crisis. Of course, European policies, hand in hand with U.S. policies, have contributed directly to the violence of war and poverty that is pushing people out of their countries. Most migrants hail from war-torn Syria, Libya, and Eritrea. Well, Chenjerai, at least this time it was 3,000 people rescued instead of dead, 55 dead, however. And rescuing is also just step one. Do you have any optimism that Europe can come up with a humane immigration response to this migration?
Well, Francois Crépeau, one of the officials in the United Nations who deals with the human rights of migrants, has suggested that a more effective response would be to charter buses to transport people to nearby shelters, register newcomers, and essentially devise a system to more equally distribute the burden of resettlement across European countries, because currently southern and eastern states, including Greece, Italy, Spain, and Hungary, are bearing most of the burden. An even more disturbing development is that many countries, European countries, are now trying to turn the refugee crisis into a law enforcement issue. We know that yesterday, Hungary and also we've seen Macedonian police fire stun grenades and tear gas at refugees. So this is really a disturbing development, and I think we need to go more with trying to sort of distribute this burden more equally across European countries.
Chenjerai, I want to thank you, as always, for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you.
Chenjerai Kumanyika is an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University. This is Uprising. You can find us online at uprisingwithsonali.com. All of our stories are posted there. If you miss anything, you can just check out that website. By the way, we're also at YouTube. That is youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Award-winning political cartoonist and commentator Ted Rall is juggling multiple stories these days. There's the story of his own entanglements with the Los Angeles Times and how the LAPD convinced the paper to stop hiring him over a long-ago encounter with cops. And then there's the new book he's just published about Edward Snowden called Simply Snowden. Both stories are complex, but at least Snowden's is well known. The LAPD, LA Times kerfuffle has mostly been viewed through the lens of the Times itself and many gleeful right-wing websites. But in a nutshell, it all started in May of this year when Rawl wrote in the LA Times about an encounter that he had had with the LAPD over 10 years ago where he was handcuffed and ticketed allegedly for jaywalking. He wrote that the officer in question roughed him up and passersby gathered yelling at the cop. The description of the encounter was in the context of a larger story he was writing of how LAPD aggressively targets people for jaywalking. But then a month ago, on July 28th, the Times effectively fired Rawl, saying that the LAPD contacted them, gave them a copy of the audio recording of that event over 10 years ago to prove that Rawl was lying. Editor Nicholas Goldberg wrote a somber note to readers declaring, quote, Rawl's future work will not appear in the Times. Well, joining me now to dissect why the Los Angeles Times might cave into the LAPD is Ted Rawl himself. Welcome to Uprising.
Thanks, Sally.
Well, the audio recording of the incident, which is at the heart of why the LA Times decided that you, as a freelance writer that they were hiring, wouldn't write for them anymore. This was, I guess, before the era of dash cams when cops had audio recordings. It was a very distorted piece of recording. The cop even starts whistling into the mic at one point. He sounds very lighthearted and casual, but there's not very much else you can glean from that tape. How did the LA Times conclude that you were lying and that the LAPD was telling the truth?
Well, it seemed pretty obvious from the very start that I was guilty until proven innocent in their minds. Honestly, I've talked to a lot of people, and I myself just can't figure out how anyone logically could listen to the original tape that was provided by the LAPD and really draw any sort of conclusion over what happened that night 14 years ago. I think it's important for your listeners to understand that after the LA Times fired me, and did not do any kind of due diligence regarding the tape, I did what they should have done. I took it to an audio enhancement company, and I had the tape enhanced. And in fact, I was able to get some more data off the tape, including voices of the people yelling at the police officer, demanding that I be freed of my handcuffs and insulting him and him interacting with them. And I contacted the Times with this new information that showed that I was telling the truth the entire time, but they chose to ignore that completely, and they did not address it at all for at least 3 weeks. So it's they just doubled down after they got back. So they're not talking. They're not answering any questions. The LA Times has shut down the comment section to their website. They're not answering reporters' phone calls. They are refusing to talk about their decision-making process, which did not involve the editorial board. They are not answering the question about who supplied them with the tape. In fact, whether it was the LAPD itself or whether it was the LAPPL, which is the police union down in LA, they won't answer questions about who received the tape at the LA Times. So they're not really acting like a newspaper. They're really acting more like a corporation that's refusing to answer questions after they know that they made a mistake and are possibly in a pre-litigation place.
Wow, is that a threat?
It's not a threat. It's been a month since they did this, and I've been dragging my feet, hoping that they'll do the right thing. I mean, look, everybody who listens to this on the internet pretty much agrees that I'm right and that the LAPD was lying and that the LA Times made the wrong decision. Anyone who wants to listen to it should just go to either my website, which is rawl.com, or the website that I work for, anewdomain.net, which has been doing most of the reporting here, or you can go to The Guardian. They have some coverage on it too, and there's links there. Anyway, all the coverage, you can just go listen to the tape for yourself. You'll see my story has been validated. Their story has not. The LAPD has been proven to be lying, and they are just, what am I supposed to do? These people have printed, the LA Times has printed a libelous and slanderous statement on their website and in the print edition of their newspapers, not once but twice, that they absolutely know are false, and they're continuing to stick to these to their story. And they're hurting my ability to earn a living as a journalist. So if I have to pursue legal action, which I don't want to do because lawsuits are expensive and time-consuming and emotionally wrenching, I will obviously have to do that.
Well, Ted, you pointed out in your own writings of this whole controversy that you were freelancing for the LA Times. If they didn't want to run your columns anymore or your work anymore, they could have simply dropped you. But they made a very clear point to, write this, detailed note. And you're saying that they essentially set out to humiliate you.
Yeah, I mean, this is the nuclear option in journalism. I mean, just to put this into perspective, if I'd really had been lying, and most newspapers still would not have published something like this. Most newspapers would have just let you go. It was a first offense, not that big a deal. It's an opinion piece. It's a blog. It's not in the print edition. The standards are lower. And so given the fact that they didn't do any due diligence, they didn't have the tape authenticated, they didn't consider the fact that when the LAPD turns over evidence to about an anti-LAPD cartoonist, that maybe the editor needs to be a little more careful. What they printed was a burn notice. They didn't just want to fire me and get rid of those cartoons. They wanted to destroy my career. that's anybody who works in journalism will say that that was what they were trying to do.
Right. Certainly, there have been journalists who have done much worse than what the LA Times is claiming you've done and been treated less badly. But it's amazing that the LAPD would contact the LA Times on their own about an incident that you wrote that happened 14 years ago and take this, you know, and take it to them. And there must have been some kind of pressure. Maybe it was strong pressure. Maybe it was not so strong. That we may never know. But the Los Angeles Police Protective League, the LAPPL that you pointed out, the union, at one point online claimed some sort of victory when you were let go. How likely is it that your critical drawing and your political cartoons and your writing of the LAPD has something to do with this?
Well, it's 100%. Let me put it this way. Let's say I was a total lying sack, and I'd been lying the entire time, and I did nothing but pro-LAPD cartoons. Do you think we'd be having this conversation today, Sonali? Hmm. No, I would still be happily cranking out cartoons every week for the LA Times. So the only reason that they did this was because of the fact that I'm so critical of police violence and LAPD ineptitude and incompetence and militarization, and have been for 6 years and beyond. And in fact, the Pasadena Weekly recently, the editor of the Pasadena Weekly, whose name is Kevin Ulrich, recently wrote a piece in the current issue of Pasadena Weekly, which is available online, in which he talked about how Pasadena police repeatedly pressured him to fire me as their cartoonist when I was doing freelance cartoons for him, many times critical of Pasadena police. So there's a pattern here, and it should be noted that the LA Times and the LAPD have a virtually incestuous relationship that if most of their readers were aware of, they would find really frightening. That not only do the cops eat at the LA Times cafeteria, because the two buildings are side by side, but on top of that, there is a financial relationship between the two entities. The police union, which has an $18 billion pension fund, all invested in the same investment company, which is called Oak Tree Capital, based in Beverly Hills, is also related to the LA Times in that Oak Tree Capital is the number one shareholder of Tribune Publishing, which is the parent company of the LA Times and 19 other newspapers. So when the LA Times, when the LAPD, which also provides tips about celebrities and crimes to the LA Times, especially now that they've laid off so many reporters, they're more and more dependent on the cops. When the LAPD calls the LA Times, they're not just a very important, heavily militarized police force who gives them news. They're also the boss. They own the paper. And back in 2009, the same union publicly stated in the LA Times, of all places, that now that they were a principal shareholder at the time of the San Diego Union Tribune, they reserved the right to hire and fire members of the editorial board down in San Diego. So it stinks. It stinks. Something stinks in LA, and it's gross, and people really just haven't known about it. I mean, I didn't know about it. Nobody ever told me that I shouldn't criticize the LAPD. If they had, I wouldn't have. Nope. All they had to do was ask nicely.
Ted, let's talk about your new book, which is just out just 2 days ago. It's called Snowden. I wish our interview could have been focused on just that and that you weren't dealing with this other stuff. Do you see, first of all, any parallels with what Snowden went through in seeing his name maligned and sort of at a micro level what you're going through?
Yeah, it's definitely on a micro level. I mean, obviously, I don't have to live in exile and I don't face life imprisonment. So I think I'm not an enemy of the state quite to that extent. But the parallel is about the interest in privacy. A lot of people in America feel that if they're not doing anything wrong, if they're not calling ISIS, they have nothing to worry about from state surveillance like of the NSA. Go ahead, listen to my phone calls. Go ahead, read my email. Knock yourselves out. But if you look at it at a situation like my tape, I didn't know that I was being taped. That tape was manipulated by the police secretly, and there's a lot of evidence that the tape was edited or spliced. Certainly, it was manipulated by the whistling that you described earlier into the microphone whenever someone was trying to talk. So, you know, the thing about evidence is that it can be changed and switched. So the NSA, for example, could target an American citizen and claim that they had evidence, but in fact that was falsified. of wrongdoing. So it's that's the thing, is that it's not neutral. And I think that's one of the things that Snowden was trying to point out, is that privacy isn't important just to hide people's wrongdoing or embarrassing porn surfing habits, but rather privacy is an important civil right that every human being needs in order to be able to feel free in his or her mind and in his or her interactions with other people and organizations. It's a really big issue for our time, and it's funny, and it's a strange coincidence that the book is coming out at this exact time.
And Ted, you are no stranger to controversies. You've taken on a lot of issues in the career that you've had. One of the other controversies that you've been caught up in recent years has been your depiction of President Obama in your cartoon. Several people have pointed out that your drawings of him look very much like an ape. And I have to admit, when I first saw them, it looked very obviously monkey-like to me. One of my interns who helps out on the show and who was not familiar with your work initially was shocked when she saw your drawings of Obama. I know you've said that they're not racist, but I'd like you to explain why.
Well, I think when you mentioned the intern that wasn't familiar with my work, I think that's maybe the key phrase. Anybody who thinks that I draw Obama like an ape should just go look at the way that I've drawn previous presidents and other political figures, whether it's Donald Trump now or President Bush before, or President Clinton and so on, or George H.W. Bush, which was the first president who I started doing in syndication. Look, human beings are apes. So if Bush looked like an ape, that's because we all look like apes. If I draw myself, I'm going to look a little ape-like. And frankly, I think, if anything, I've been very flattering of President Obama because he's a very handsome guy. So I tend to go easy on him in terms of his looks. And also, I am cognizant of the fact that he's our first ever African-American president. But, you know, at the same time, political cartooning is about caricature, and it's caricature is an important part of it. And I'm not going to change my overall drawing style, except to temper it a little bit, in allowance of the fact that he is our first black president, and there is a history of racist caricature in political cartooning that I try to eschew. But at the same time, I would expect that the president himself would say that he expects to be treated the same way that any white president would be treated by political satirists. And I think that I have certainly been more than fair to him in terms of the depiction of him in my work. And I would say that the controversy also is kind of interesting in that I was drawing him like that for the better part of 8 years before Daily Kos, the blog, suddenly noticed that I was drawing him like that.
I see. Well, I'll certainly encourage our audience to check out your work online, come to their own conclusions, check out also, of course, the controversy around the LA Times, LAPD, and your new book, Snowden, at your website. Can you give it out?
Sure, it's just rall.com, RALL.com.
Ted, thanks so much for joining us. Best of luck.
Thank you, Sonali.
Ted Rall is an award-winning political cartoonist and commentator, and his earlier books include To Afghanistan and Back and Silk Road to Ruin. His latest book is just out a couple of days ago. It's called Snowden. Again, his website is rall.com, RALL.com. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. The shooting of a reporter and her cameraman on live television near Roanoke, Virginia, yesterday morning has brought to the forefront yet again the scourge of gun violence. 24-year-old Allison Parker, 27-year-old Adam Ward were in the middle of an interview outdoors at a water park being broadcast live when shots were heard, followed by screams. The alleged perpetrator was a former employee of the television station named Vester Flanagan, who went by the screen name of Bryce Williams. Flanagan filmed himself shooting the two people and posted the video to social media. He also sent a fax to the television station claiming to have been provoked by the Charleston church shooting and expressing admiration for the 1999 shooters of Columbine High School and the 2007 mass shooter at Virginia Tech. Flanagan was eventually found by police and killed himself. Mass shootings in the U.S. are increasingly common, and while public support for gun control remains strong, the NRA continues to claim that, well, guns don't kill people, people kill people. Now, a new study about mass shootings in the U.S. offers what its author calls empirical evidence that a nation's civilian firearm ownership rate is the strongest predictor of its number of public mass shooters. In other words, it is the guns. My guest is Adam Lankford. He is the researcher. He's a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice at the University of Alabama and the author of the study on mass shootings. Welcome to Uprising, Adam.
Hi, nice to speak with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, let's first talk about how you conducted your research. What data did you use? What did you leave out in examining mass shootings in the U.S., this ugly phenomenon?
Sure. Well, the goal was relatively simple, and it was to find essentially evidence of all attackers, public mass shooters from 1966 to 2012 around the world. And to build that database, I used the FBI active shooter report, NYPD active shooter report, and a variety of international sources. I was specifically focused on offenders who killed a minimum of four victims. So that helped ensure that I was studying offenders who I could find, because there was clear records of them doing these horrible things.
And so yesterday's shooting wouldn't have qualified. There were two victims. A third was recovering in the hospital. However, the alleged perpetrator who killed himself did claim to be inspired by three, at least, mass shootings, one of which he said sort of provoked him to do what he did, the other two of which he said he sort of expressed an admiration for.
Right. So, you know, when you're doing a scientific study, you have to have strict lines about what counts and what doesn't. But the reality, of course, is that human behavior is more complex than that. You know, I think certainly behaviorally, this guy is very similar to the offenders I studied.
And I want to get to that, because you do sort of look at what drives mass shooters as well. Let's talk about how you came to the conclusion that the U.S. Compares well with other countries where there are lots of guns available. You looked at data from other gun-rich countries. Can you explain the sort of international context?
Sure. So basically, for 171 countries, I could find the firearm ownership rate. And I also looked at a host of other variables: homicide rate, suicide rate, GDP per capita, how urbanized different nations were. And basically running the statistical tests, you know, the tests themselves tell you what's significant. There's no subjectivity there. So the test showed that firearm ownership rate in countries, most kind of clearly the United States, which leads the world in firearm ownership rate, but also in countries like Switzerland, Finland, Yemen, Serbia, explain the high number of public mass shooters in those nations.
And actually, when you say the U.S. leads the world in ownership rate, do you mean that per capita we have more guns than another country, than any other country in the world, or just overall absolute number of guns?
Unfortunately, the answer is both. So we have more than 200 million actual firearms than the second highest country, and our rate is almost double the second highest country. So either way you slice it, we're number one when it comes to firearms, unfortunately.
More than Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, more than, you know, countries where there's more than the Ukraine?
Right. So these are civilian firearms. And yeah, we have more than 270 million in this country. The second highest country was actually India with 46 million. So you think India's population is much bigger than the United States, and yet the discrepancy in number of civilian firearms is tremendous.
So how did the U.S. compare in terms of the actual mass shootings? I understand that one of the things you found that was that mass shooters in the U.S. are likely to use more weapons when they go out and commit these horrific murders.
Right. So, you know, one of the things I did was model why some countries have more attackers than others. And another thing is look at the criminal behavior of these attackers. And as you suggested, one of the things I found was attackers in the United States are more likely to use multiple weapons. And all around the world, there's a correlation for these public mass shooters between using more weapons and killing more victims. Yeah, you know, it's a problematic scenario, and the attacker yesterday apparently only had one firearm. that may be one reason why his fatality count was a little bit lower.
But is there a reason why American mass shooters use multiple weapons? Is it just that there's so many guns that they're just doubling up?
I think so, and keep in mind that, you know, these are premeditated attacks.
Yeah.
You know, so often they're planning them for weeks or months, you know, sometimes even longer, and there's a sense of, particularly because there's a suicidal element for a lot of these offenders as well, that, you know, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory, that's the perception, and take as many people with me as possible.
One of the other differences you found that sort of surprised me was that the average number of victims killed by each shooter was actually higher in other countries than in the U.S. So that means the mass shooters in other countries that are fewer arms floating around per attack are killing more people than those in the U.S.?
Right. And so that might sound contradictory. Mm-hmm. It's actually not. In other words, everywhere you use multiple weapons, you kill more victims. But that surplus, that extra number of victims killed was even higher in other countries. And I think what's going on there is a difference in law enforcement response. So we learned from incidents like Columbine. At Columbine, it took 3 hours for that scene to be resolved. And in the meantime, people were dying. So we've learned that these situations are active shooter scenarios. These shooters need to be made no longer active as quickly as possible, because we've had so many attacks, and elsewhere in the world, they haven't necessarily learned that lesson.
Well, I'm wondering, just following from that, if the prevalence of so many weapons in the United States gives American police the excuse to arm themselves to the teeth and draw their guns whenever, even when people are unarmed. I mean, all they have to say is, I thought he was reaching for his gun, and we have so many guns that excuse can hold water for juries.
Right. It's a tricky thing because you have some cops who are naturally trying to do the right thing, but may have legitimate fears because there's so many firearms in this country. But of course, that could also be used as an excuse. And it's hard for juries to disentangle, you know, the well-meaning police officers from those who might have more questionable motives or more questionable instincts.
Now, let's talk about the fact that you say this. You basically say that your study found empirical evidence that the more guns a country has, the more shootings there will be. Explain that to our lay audience. When you say there's empirical evidence, what does that mean?
Well, it essentially means it's not subjective, you know. So, you know,
It sounds obvious to me. It's like saying if there's more ice cream in my house, I'm going to eat more ice cream, you know. But if I just don't have it in the house, I won't get to eat it. So it sounds like an obvious thing. But of course, the NRA doesn't think it's obvious. So you're trying to prove it.
Right. Well, the empirical part, though, is if the NRA sat down on my computer and ran the test, you know, they pressed the button, they're going to come up with the same result. So based on the history of 1966 to 2012. Now, the future can always change, but it would be unprecedented for in the future us to have a lot of firearms and for this problem to suddenly disappear.
So many people cite the example of Australia and how reducing the number of guns dramatically reduces mass shootings, which, you know, if it's true that having lots of guns increases the likelihood of mass shootings, then the opposite should be true. What lessons are there to be learned from Australia?
Well, Australia reacted very proactively, or actually, I guess it's reactively, to a terrible mass shooting that killed 35 people there. And after that, they passed major gun control restrictions. They had a buyback program that reduced the number of guns in that country by 20%. And in the wake of those policies, they haven't had another public mass shooting since. So, I mean, I'm not sure we'd have that kind of immediate success in this country, but it's clear evidence that there's a reduction in firearms and a reduction in the number of attacks.
Turning back to the incident yesterday, Vester Flanagan, the alleged shooter, in his suicide note expressed how upset he was at his treatment by his colleagues. He worked at the same television station 2 years ago. He said his colleagues were biased against him for being black and gay. And I want to quote what you said earlier this week before yesterday's horrific live television shooting that now seems so eerily relevant. Your statements were so relevant. You said about this study before the shooting, in the United States, where many individuals are socialized to assume that they will reach great levels of success and achieve, quote, the American dream, there may be particularly high levels of strain among those who encounter blocked goals or have negative social interactions with their peers, coworkers, or bosses. That seems to be right on the mark. So basically, the combination of a lot of guns with what you call delusions of grandeur makes an explosive combination, literally.
Right. And when you add in the mental illness element, you often have these distorted perceptions where, you know, rather than handling adversity in kind of a humble or healthy way, these attackers usually are looking for someone to blame. And they have these distorted ideas that, you know, everyone's out to get me, everyone's mistreating me. The attackers actually claim that they're victims themselves, and that's how they justify their violence. I'm a victim and I'm just striking back. Hmm. But of course, that's not really what's going on.
But the NRA likes the idea, as does Donald Trump, who just this morning, likes to fixate on, well, it's mental illness. We need to deal with mental illness and not guns. And they're trying to separate the two.
Right. Well, you know, I guess the fact is these public mass shooters are both mentally ill, in the vast majority of cases, and they have guns, you know. But I guess what I would say is, you know, what my study shows is there isn't a country in the world that has a tremendous number of guns and doesn't have this problem. So, you know, if the NRA thinks that that's, you know, some sort of magic solution, again, that would be unprecedented around the world.
I'm sure Australia has mentally ill people, but
right, and in fact. In fact, just to add to that, one of the other things I tested was suicide rates. Mm-hmm. And there is no correlation globally between countries that have high levels of suicide having some sort of high levels of public mass shooters.
Interesting. Well, Adam, where can people find your study? I understand you're going to be presenting it. Has it been published yet?
I presented it this week already at the American Sociological Association's conference. It will be forthcoming in academic journals. And I guess I just say, you know, stay posted for that.
Your website, would you like to give out that?
Sure. People can keep track. My website is adamlankford.com.
Thank you so much, Adam, for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
My guest is Adam Lankford. He's a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice at the University of Alabama. He's the author of a new study on mass shootings. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. At least 9 people, including a police officer, have been killed in the Indian state of Gujarat over caste-related protests and riots. Upper caste Gujaratis, known as Patels or the Patidar community, have brought their state's main city, Ahmedabad, to a standstill over what they perceive as unfair treatment. India's affirmative action programs aimed at tribal and Dalit people are aimed at undermining casteism. But now Gujarat's Patels say they've had enough. According to the BBC, internet services on mobile phones have been suspended, schools and businesses are closed, and public transport cancelled in Ahmedabad and other parts of the state. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who hails from Gujarat, appealed for calm, saying that violence had, quote, never done good for anyone. Ironically, it was under Mr. Modi's watch that Gujarat saw its worst violence more than a decade ago when a pogrom by fundamentalist Hindus against the state's Muslim community left thousands dead. Joining me now is Thenmori Soundararajan. She is a Dalit American filmmaker and transmedia artist, co-founder of the International Women's Media Technology Collective Third World Majority. Welcome to Uprising, Thenmori.
Hi, good
Hi.
morning, Sonali. Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. A young man named Hardik Patel, Thenmori, is at the forefront of this movement of upper caste Gujaratis, and he was arrested on Tuesday. His arrest sparked rioting. He's claiming that the Patidar community, this is the upper caste community of Indians, is equivalent to a tribal or a Dalit caste. And he wants this classification so that his community can take advantage of the quota system and the affirmative action policies that India has had. Why does this community, which is at the top of the sort of socioeconomic ladder in India and has been historically, why do they feel so oppressed? Aren't they the privileged caste?
Well, I think that's really what the conversation needs to be about, is their incredible privilege. So when we're talking about the Patel community, we have to recognize their incredible wealth diasporically, but also they are a land-owning caste in Gujarat. Like the entire origin of the term Patidar, which gave rise to the Patel caste, means entitlement. And so their penetration in terms of multiple industries, from the diamond industry to business to the government, and the amount of positions that they've had in terms of the state legislature, is they are in control without doubt. So for them to kind of say that they're in a position that requires reservation really betrays the idea of what reservation was meant to restore. And you know, for American audiences, reservation is the affirmative action policy in India that was meant to address the generations of violence and caste discrimination that many Dalits and other backward castes face under caste apartheid. So it's a restorative policy meant to try to give Dalits an even footing in, with regards to the entire infrastructure of India being based within this de facto apartheid system.
Now,
so,
I should add a note on terms. The Indian government has long used the term OBC, which, believe it or not, for our audience, stands for the other backward classes, in reference to groups that have historically been disadvantaged. So the Patels want to be labeled, quote, backward too, so that they can take advantage of these programs. One writer declared the affluent Patel clan owns a quarter of U.S. motels in India. It wants to be called backward. How do you respond to that, Thenmori?
Well, I mean, I think that's why this is really a disingenuous conversation, because when you hear his ask is that either Patels get are able to be qualified as OBCs and get reservation, or all reservations need to be abolished.
And what by reservation, you mean essentially explain that term.
So reservation, once again, is the affirmative action policy in India.
So it's like a quota.
Yes, that basically allows for a certain position of government positions, of school admissions, and other kind of like state subsidies to be guaranteed to those who have a harder access to getting those services or those positions because of structural oppression. And I think that the conversation about reservation always gets seen that unqualified, you know, lower caste candidates are taking these positions. But I think one thing that none of these arguments ever deal with is the fact that caste atrocity is still unabated in the state of Gujarat. So when we're talking about caste violence and untouchability practice in Gujarat, there was a recent report by the Navsarjan Trust done by the Robert Kennedy Center for Human Rights that said 98% of villages in Gujarat still practice untouchability. There's been a 500 increase of rape of Dalit women in 2014 since 2001, and 90% of all of the cases around caste atrocity are still pending in Gujarat cases. So whatever slights that the Patel community feels that they are unable to access these government positions, they are without a doubt not facing the systemic structural violence of caste atrocity and caste-based sexual violence that prevents many Dalits and other backward communities from being able to fully engage with these structures that allow people to progress.
So what you're saying is that even if we set aside the demands by the Patidar community, who are at the top of the caste system in India, that there is a very severe level, an epidemic level of violence from upper castes aimed at lower castes in India, so-called lower castes, the Dalit communities in India, that doesn't seem to be as important an issue for them to take up.
Absolutely. And I think that it's really, you know, once again, when you look at the history of the Patel community, they had a series of protests in the 80s that were against reservation. So a lot of like how I view this recent outrage is not so much about them being demanding reservation, but it's a continuing conversation within their community to abolish this affirmative action policy as a whole. And I think that we, all of those who stand with Dalit and OBC communities and people who believe that there needs to be a restorative process for those who've been impacted by caste apartheid, we kind of see the wolf in sheep's clothing here. And we know that this is not the way to go, and nor is this a candidate that should have the kind of support by, you know, liberal-minded people.
Hmm. Time magazine described the community, the Patidar community or Patels, in these terms. The Patels run several small and medium businesses, not just in India, but in the U.S., Europe, and Africa. They're also key players in India's diamond trade and have been major supporters of the Bharatiya Janata Party that Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi belongs to since the late 1980s. This is, of course, a fundamentalist party, and Narendra Modi, who is not a Patel, but certainly has been supported by this community. He is, him and his supporters represent a fundamentalist ideology. That is also something that needs to be part of the conversation, right?
And absolutely. And I think that it's really interesting because, you know, a lot of the work that we've been doing with the campaign, the Dalit Women Fight, and the work with the All India Dalit Women's Rights Forum has really been to show the links of how fundamentalism in the diaspora and casteism of communities in the diaspora is very, very connected to fundamentalism that breeds within our home countries. And the reality is that when you have Patels here and other upper caste members here say that they are casteless, when in fact they're supporting their families to continue this conversation, this is one clear point of intervention where we can really, as a global South Asian progressive community, start to create a counter narrative, you know, that if we really want to end caste, if we really want to annihilate caste, it's not about ending reservation, it's about ending caste supremacy. And this is exactly one of those examples.
Now, inside Gujarat, the current chief minister, who is also a Patel, which is an indication, actually, of that community's influence, that, you know, one member of their community is actually in the highest position in the state, Anandiben Patel, he has so far refused the demands of the Patel community to be seen as a caste that can take advantage of the reservation system. If he were to give in, then the affirmative action policies, the quotas, would mean nothing, would they?
Well, I mean, I think that this is why they've really kind of like backed themselves into a corner, because Gujarat currently is at capacity for reservation, and reservation as a restorative policy was not meant to keep people who have land, who have power, who are enactors of violence, to then have reprivileged positions within institutions to better help their economics. So I think it's a total sham. And I think once again, they know that they're not going to get their concession. And so this is really a larger question, not to include them into reservation, but to abolish reservation as a whole. And that's why I think that Dalits and other people that are aligned around the question of keeping restorative policies to address the violence of the caste apartheid system really see that this is a wolf in sheep's clothing argument, and that we can't really afford to be distracted by this.
And then, Marie, can we draw an analogy to the U.S., where some white Americans have railed against the very weak and modest affirmative action policies around the country because they feel that it disadvantages them, even though they have all of society's advantages? We've seen affirmative action cases at the Supreme Court over this. It seems like it's a similar thing.
Well, and there's really interesting. There was an article in the New York Times that led with the story of the young woman who got denied access to UT Austin, denied in air quotes, of course.
Who's at the heart of the Supreme Court case? Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And the New York Times used that as an entry to discuss the Brahmins that were being discriminated against in respect to the reservation policies, right? And so I think that there's a lot of people that try to make that analogy, but I think if you really are going to make the analogy between caste and race, you have to look at the structural nature of racism in the United States and the structural nature of casteism within India. And when you're talking about, you know, structural aspects of casteism in India, you're looking at like 100% of all corporate boards being made up of upper caste people. You're talking about 100% of all of the boards of all of the major media institutions being owned and represented by upper caste people. You're also talking about less than 1% of all journalists being Dalits, you know. So I don't actually feel like we're getting accurate representation in both the U.S. and in India. And I think particularly in the U.S., like really it was only, I think, with the conversation in Black Lives Matters that there's been an even more deeper investigation with white supremacy and its denial of the violence that has allowed the structural supremacy of white communities within all of our policies. So in many ways, I think that while there is this legal narrative that's happening, the on-the-ground grassroots narrative that really keeps the center on the lives that are at the heart of this these violent systems are really what are continuing to kind of keep the importance of the need for these restorative policies in place.
There was an interesting statement made by a Patel who works for Amnesty International's office in India, Akar Patel. He's a political commentator, and he said to the LA Times, "It's laughable. They have had, Patels have had access to modernity and capital for a century and a half. Almost every person in central Gujarat, where Patels dominate, has family members in the US and UK." And I think, Tenmori, this goes back to what you were saying about the sort of international links that this Patel community has had. And, you know, most Americans are familiar with, you know, there's, of course, the stereotypical Patel owner of the motels here. And even if within the United States, Patels aren't, motel owners aren't necessarily reaching the upper levels of the 1% in the United States, relative to India, there's certainly a lot of privilege.
No, without a doubt. And I think this is like the real call to action with this story is that the longer that those of us who are South Asian in the diaspora deny the existence of caste, like amongst our ranks, the longer that we keep silence about how we create a climate of compliance and also financial support for caste atrocity, caste apartheid, and Hindu fundamentalism in our home countries. And I think it's a real call to action for those communities that are upper caste, that are members of the Patel, to really change and shift the narrative. Because really, I think that, you know, caste apartheid is a system that's been in existence for thousands of years. And for us to end this in our lifetime, we need to be able to start naming the silence that really exists around the continuity of caste, and really just breaking it once and for all. And in the words of Dr. Ambedkar, we must educate, agitate, and organize so that we can annihilate caste in our lives.
And explain for our American audiences who Dr. Ambedkar was.
So Dr. Ambedkar is the Dalits leader who is our equivalent of both a Martin Luther King and a Malcolm X. But he was this incredible towering figure who not only wrote the Indian Constitution, but really paved the way for having a man of letters who could speak to so many disciplines of what our liberation can look like. And he had a correspondence with W.E.B. Du Bois. He was one of the first Indians to attend Columbia. And my sense is that the more people know about the Dalit intellectual tradition and they know about figures like Dr. Ambedkar, the more that they know that there is a deep historical challenge to caste apartheid, and the less likely they're going to fall for people like Hardik Patel that are just kind of selling, spinning stories to be able to continue their privilege and ignore the violence that continues past apartheid in Gujarat.
And Ambedkar is spelled A-M-B-E-D-K-A-R, if our audience wants to look that name up. Now, speaking of violence, that's exactly what has been playing out in Gujarat this week. I mentioned 9 people and a police officer killed. There are riots in Gujarat right now that are being characterized as the worst caste-based violence to hit Gujarat in more than a decade. What does that violent response mean? How significant is it that a community with privilege that is demanding more privilege is using so much violence to assert itself?
Well, I think this is the terrible, tragic reality, is that when we see forward castes like the Patels enact violence in the public sphere like this, it is only a reminder of the kind of violence that they've waged against Dalit communities for centuries. You know, when we talk about acts of caste-based sexual violence that look at people being paraded naked, being burned, being raped or stripped naked in public, when we're talking about the kinds of massacres that we saw of other religious minorities in the Gujarat riots, the idea of dominant caste using violence to make political points is the reality that cements caste apartheid. That is, in fact, caste terror, and it's the heart of caste atrocity. So to see it bubbling in this way is heartbreaking, and my heart goes out to the communities that are Dalit and other Bahujan communities in Gujarat, because the target for them, I think for these Patels, you know, once they get done with the state, will be our communities.
Right.
Because that's already the conversation that's happening. These are unqualified people taking our positions. And as they go to these protests in these very expensive cars to show strength that they actually are weak, that need a reservation, the whole thing is like a total farce, you know.
Tenmori, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your analysis with us.
Oh, sure. Thank you very much. And I just encourage people, as they start to explore this issue, to also start to look at the growing conversation about the diaspora saying no to Modi and the Modi protests that are going to be coming onto the West Coast at the end of September.
Thank you. This
is really the time to really not just engage with this question in Gujarat, but look at the state of Hindu fundamentalism in India as a whole.
Thank you so much. And you can follow my guest Tenmori on Twitter at Dalit Diva. Tenmori Sandararajan is a Dalit American filmmaker and transmedia artist, co-founder of the International Women's Media Technology Collective Third World Majority. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Jonathan Alexander sitting in for Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Kiana Turner is our visual editor. Teddy Robinson is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Jonathan Alexander for all his other help that he gives us. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/UprisingWithSonali. Our website is UprisingWithSonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.